So welcome to the NFX podcast, and we'd like to welcome Alex Babin, the CEO of Hercules AI, on today. Alex, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, James. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, well, you and I have known each other now for 7 years. We gave you a pre-seed check way back in 2017. You've been working on Hercules since 2014. You're well ahead of the current boom in AI. And so we thought it would be great for our listeners to hear your thoughts about where AI is today and learn more about Hercules AI and why you're doing what you're doing. So Alex, you just quickly give us some background on you.
I'm Alex Babin, CEO and co-founder of Hercules AI. I was born in Russia and moved to Bay Area about 12 years ago with my first startup, which was also in AI space, but interactive video, object recognition. My co-founder and I, we live in Campbell and San Jose here in Bay Area. My co-founder, Gevorg, is also into AI, but he has been building before joining Xero, he's been, and then Hercules, he's been building skin cancer image detection algorithms. He probably saved more lives with his work than I ever met people in my life. And then we joined forces to build Hercules AI to actually save time so people can spend it on the important stuff instead of repetitive tasks.
Got it. And how many people are on the team right now?
So right now about 90 people spread across multiple countries. Our headquarters here in Campbell, Silicon Valley. We have office in Canada, in New York, and development office in Armenia.
Fantastic. So I guess, you know, we met years and years ago, and recently you've changed the name of the company. Could you quickly tell us sort of the basics about what you do and then why you changed the name to Hercules?
Originally, the company called Xero Systems, which is a quite good name for a technology company. And it was standing for zero time wasted for knowledge workers. But recently, not just our product offering expanded, but also the tasks we build AI products for expanded dramatically. And some of those tasks are so hard to automate that at some point we realized that the name doesn't reflect what we're doing. Herculean efforts, cleaning Augean's tables, and things like this, that's what AI is doing now. And the reflection of the name change was basically because we're doing so many things that before were considered impossible. Now it has a broader meaning that Hercules can take care of those things.
Well, and you know, you and I were actually on a whiteboard, I think, when the name change came up about a year and a half ago. Is that right?
Yes, and it was your idea. You looked at our product and said, wait a second, guys, your platform called Hercules AI, and you are not putting it in front of your customers, the name, which is great name to describe what you're doing. Why you are hiding the great name behind the scenes? And we flipped it over. So now Hercules AI is both the name of the company and the brand and the product itself. And I would tell you, James, it paid off nicely because people love it. Absolutely. Everyone loves Hercules. Everyone is neutral about Xero because Xero is neutral, right?
Well, that's great. I'm glad it's paying off. It makes life more fun to have a great name as well. So let's turn it back to 2014, well before the latest AI moment that we're having now. So you're working on the idea of an AI model that could summarize long form texts into concise, easily consumable like snippets, right? Like saving people hours and boosting productivity. Where did you get that key insight? And, you know, who were your first customers?
Yeah. So actually, we were classic approach of the technology in the search of a problem, because the problem itself was very challenging. And again, it was pre-LLM, pre-transformer architecture, pre-everything. It was when AI was still called ML and NLP. Not sexy, right? Not like right now. But we encountered the problem when we realized that summarization, like the consumption of the text information, consumes the most of the time from the end users when they are processing information. And it doesn't matter what industry it is. You might be a lawyer, you might be a financial analyst, you might be a reporter. It doesn't matter. Consuming text, understanding it, summarizing it, and extracting valuable insight from it is essential part of every single workflow for knowledge workers. And we decided to attack this problem. And of course, it was pre-LLM. We started building our RNN models. But to make things even more challenging, we decided to build all the models working on Edge. Like, it was not enough to build complexity to build a model that would work for general type of text.
You were trying to build it on the Edge, meaning so that it would run on my smartphone.
Correct.
Without having to go back to a server for security reasons.
Actually not. Security came later. It was a byproduct. You know why we did it? We didn't have money to run it in the cloud. We were cheap. We said, wait a second, smartphones are powerful enough to process those small models. Let's use the devices of our end users to actually do the processing. And then later, it came back to us that, wait a second, but it's also secure. And that allowed us to enter regulated industries where you cannot send the data outside of the security perimeter. And that was probably one of the most important things that happened accidentally. I would love to claim it, saying, well, we were smart enough to predict that in the future you'll need to run LLMs on edge devices or inside security perimeter. But unfortunately not. We were just trying to save money and build something to run on a client infrastructure at ours.
Got it. And so then you ended up with your first customers being in these regulated industries where security was really important. And then you got the system to be more and more secure, more and more robust. Is that right?
Correct. And once we made the first model work, and it was still pre-LLM, pre-transformers, it was incredibly hard to do that. But we managed to do it, and it worked. And we started looking for a beachhead market, because beachhead market in enterprise is critically important. I still do believe that it's impossible to build something generally available and applicable everywhere. At least not at the very beginning. You have to focus and you have to be finding this beachhead market that you can tap into. For us, it became legal, large law firms. And that's where you and I met, James. And I still remember pitching you, telling you, hey, we're building this automation products for legal vertical for large law firms. And you told me it was brave and stupid enough at the same time, because actually it's one of the hardest market to sell. But at that moment, we already got a couple of clients and they loved the product. And it still was incredibly hard to sell, but also had some benefits. And then later, of course, it expanded to much broader markets, but still inside regulated industries, insurance, financial services, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, you know the legal tech industry, the legal customers have been really hard to sell into for the last 20, 25 years. They've been very slow to adopt new technologies. That has changed in the last 3 or 4 years. And I think, you know, we've got other companies in the NFX Guild, you know, like Darrow and EvenUp and whatnot that have been doing great with legal tech. And you were a beneficiary of that, but you very quickly got out of just selling to legal folks, going to consulting companies and that kind of thing. What would you tell yourself back in 2014 or 17 when you were cranking away, building your own ML models and trying to get this sort of small version of LLMs to work? What would you tell yourself today?
I would say one of the most important things that we realized later than I wish we did is quality. Quality of enterprise products, it's not just related to legal. Of course, legal, large law firms are very demanding, but every enterprise product company is very demanding. And the approach, move fast and break things, doesn't work well. So we entered the market really fast with a half-baked product and started getting clients. And I think we were absolutely lucky not to lose any of those clients, because we substituted the lack of quality of the first product. It was like MVP, of course. We substituted it with absolute obsession with the customer engagement quality. So, and that allowed us to not lose any clients. And we still have all the clients since 2017, 2018. We still have them with us. And now they're buying more products and they say that we are the best vendor they ever worked with. So I would say, if I had to tell myself back then what to do and what not to do, I would say slow down and spend more time on making the product better before trying to scale it. Because we've been always under impression that Silicon Valley startups, no matter what you do, should scale incredibly fast. But that comes back and bite you in the back later. And we only managed to survive that kind of a tornado of quality that was not still there by being obsessed with clients. And they forgave us everything because of that. Now, when the products are on the next level, it's much easier to look back and say, well, we should have pay more attention to the engineering debt and not spend too much time building new features until we polish the existing ones. But hindsight 2020, it's basically what I would say to myself.
Got it. So let's talk about where you've evolved to today with Hercules AI. So now you're a platform that allows, you know, the assembly of what, lots of different AI applications in days or weeks, not months or years. And that lets you expand into more industries. Where are you today? And who are your customers and what problems are you solving for them?
Yeah. So let's start with what we actually do. So Hercules' platform to assemble, like an assembly line, right, in manufacturing, but to assemble virtual AI workers. Let's unpack what virtual AI worker is, and then it would be obvious who we're selling it to and who is using it, who's benefiting from it. So virtual AI worker is basically a replica, a twin of a particular specialist. Might be a lawyer, but again, not doing the practice of law, doing a business of law, doing operations, everything that people don't like doing. Or it might be financial analyst, analyzing prospectuses, might be operator doing private equity capital calls processing, and so on and so forth. So what we do believe in is that humans doing hard jobs on minimal wage while robots write poetry and paint pictures is not the future we all want. We want machines, AI, to take care of those mundane and repetitive tasks so people can actually focus on creative things. I know it goes a bit against the grain of generative AI as it is right now, which generates pictures and music and everything, and it's fine. For us, our mission is to build the AI-powered workforce to actually enable people to spend more time on doing productive things. And it's been always, from very beginning of the company, it's always been the same. And if we look at the greatest companies in recent years who emerged on top of existing industries, for example, Uber, right? It's the largest taxi company in the world without having any cars on balance sheet. We look at Airbnb, it's the biggest hotel chain in the world without having any property. What we want to build the largest workforce company in the world without having anyone on payroll. Because those are AI virtual workers. We give them to our clients to do the work that typically people are doing. And as Sam Altman was saying, there would be companies, billion-dollar companies, that are run by a couple of people, an army of AI robots. So that's exactly what we do. But looking backwards, when we started, we've been building on top of something that is very well hidden elephant in the room. There is a trillion-dollar problem on the market. We call it invisible problem. Everyone knows about, but no one's talking about clunky old software. And organizations run on software. Might be ERP, might be CRM, might be anything. There are thousands and thousands of pieces of software in each organization. These pieces are not connected. People are jumping between them, doing some manual work, and so on and so forth. So we build virtual workers to actually interconnect that software, but not just software, people as well, different departments. And that's exactly what virtual workers are. We started them building vertically one by one, started in legal, automating compliance, time capturing, quote to cash, invoices, those things that actually consume a lot of time. And then went into enterprise, broader enterprise like insurance, financial services, and others. But we stayed inside the boundaries of regulated industries.
Got it. And it feels like there's a ton of companies doing this, no? How do you stand out?
Of course. So there's so many companies that want to make sure that people spend time on what's really important. They do it, they're all addressing it differently. Let's imagine a spectrum, right? Like the line. On one side, that would be RPA with a very simple processes to automate. Even if you add AI to it, it's still going to be AI-powered RPA, robotic process automation. But on the other side, there might be gigantic projects being taken care of by C3 AI or Palantir, which are amazing companies, but their projects are gigantic. What we do, we've built Hercules as a platform, as assembly line. You can take components that already exist and working and tested with many customers and assemble the application, the virtual worker, with our help, of course, assemble it pretty quickly and put it into works to automate those very complex workflows. So we're in the basically sweet spot of intersection of very complex workflows automated by AI virtual workers, which can be delivered really, really quickly. We're talking about weeks, not even months.
And so are you going into any particular types of companies, high security, mid security, large companies, medium sized companies? Are you going into companies with like a Snowflake implementation or Okta?
Yeah, we focus on the large enterprises. Some of our customers are Fortune 1000, actually most of them, bigger enterprises. They all care about security. And also they are in regulated industries, again, financial services, insurance, and legal. That means that we need to support all of the infrastructure they already have. And you can't build something like this to support all of those underlying infrastructure overnight. That what took us 7 years to build. Hercules has 200 components. For example, if a client using Snowflake and Okta, we can support it. And the virtual worker is going to be delivered exactly that exactly fits the enterprise infrastructure. This is critically important. And another important thing for enterprises is cost of ownership. If they already have systems in place, they do not want to change those or rip and replace. It's important for the new technology, new products to work on top of what exists already.
And so what's the typical process when you come into a company? You say, look, we're going to give you additional workers. We're going to charge you a SaaS fee. How do you charge folks?
We charge $300,000 per AI worker per year. It's SaaS, though unlike many other AI companies, we are not hosting those AI systems on our side. Remember, they are running on infrastructure of our clients. So our margins are incredibly high. If you compare with other companies where you need to spend enormous amount of money on GPUs and infrastructure, we don't have those costs. And also for clients, it gives predictability of how much it will cost. We don't have variable cost, and clients have it inside the security perimeter. So this is one of the most important things for clients right now, because we've seen clients prototyping themselves using available tools on the market, and they see that the cost running things, even on the infrastructure, is astronomical. And sometimes they are saying, wait a second, I'd better wait until it becomes cheaper, better, and faster. Though it promises enormous benefits, it's still far away from enterprise-grade product. And I'll wait, and it's too expensive to run. So I'll wait. But if they have an alternative, like with us, they just can grab it, install it, and have it up and running in a matter of weeks.
And then they know exactly what their costs are going to be.
Exactly. It's very predictable. But there are other things that are critically important. I've seen companies, startups, that are jumping in and trying to build enterprise solution without thinking how much it will cost for a client. So, for example, we are using hybrid approach, GPU, CPU. You can the virtual worker can use GPUs for specific tasks, but then CPUs kicks in and you can run smaller models on CPUs, making it very, very inexpensive, basically utilizing the existing infrastructure. So for clients, it's critical to know how much it will cost at scale.
Got it. And so you're using one particular LLM, or you're using multiple?
We have about 9 right now. Some of them are smaller, and those are ours. And of course, we use the best, the best in class, like Llama and Mistral, because we don't want to train our own models. We fine tune them. We make them specialized. For example, we just released a new model called Rosetta Stone. Why it's called Rosetta Stone? Because it does something that no other model in the world is doing. It's structured data transformation. It's like ETL, but without rules. It takes any structured data and turns it into another type of any structured data. It's just 7 billion parameters, but it beats GPT-4 by 30%.
Got it. So this Rosetta Stone comes with your product when somebody becomes a client of Zeus. It's something you guys develop. Because you've developed your own ML models, which you're still using.
Yes.
And now you're actually adding some of the other models. And Rosetta Stone is just another example of another one that you built internally yourself.
You're right. And there is also interesting thing about quality of AI products. And it also gets back to what models are being used, and not just what models, how they are being used. So we all know about hallucinations, right? It's a pretty big problem. And more complex the workflow you want to apply LLM to, more complex it is, more hallucinations you will have. And of course, there are techniques to battle it. But actually, the best way we found is neurosymbolic AI. It's where LLM provides some output, might be extraction, extract something from a document or a database or whatever. And then another LLM turns it into rules. But the rules are 100% accurate, and then delivers those rules to another LLM. And that's how you avoid error propagation when you build very complex systems. For example, some of our AI virtual AI workers, they have 4 or 5 LLMs working as ensemble, one after another. And in order to remove this error propagation, you have to have neurosymbolic AI. And we had to build models that actually do that. It was pretty labor intensive, but now we can chain any models together and make sure that they provide absolutely highest possible quality.
Got it. So this goes back to your discussion of how you built out the infrastructure and the processes to really take care of the customers so that it's easy for them to implement without hallucinations. You didn't actually come up with Llama or with GPT-4, but you figured out how to structure them and implement them inside these large organizations.
Yes, we believe LLMs are already a commodity, and they're going to be cheaper, faster, and better. And it's normal. For example, right now, James, you don't care where electricity is coming when you're making coffee in the morning in your coffee machine. You care about the quality of your coffee. And that's exactly the same going to be happening with LLMs. They're going to be
so you're predicting that the cost and the stickiness of a GPT-4 or 5 or 6 compared to an Anthropic, compared to a Llama, is going to go to zero.
I would say it's going to be so easy to switch between them if you have the infrastructure in place. So, for example, I'll give you another example. Right now, let's say we give our customer AI application, AI virtual worker that has like 5 models inside, and one of the models is Llama 2. Next year, or this year, Llama 3 being released, for example. How do you swap the models without rebuilding the whole application from scratch? We learned that hard way 5 years ago before LLMs, because we needed to update models. So we have a module, which could be a separate startup on its own, that does model swapping. And for example, reinforcement learning data is stored in a separate database. And when you replace the model automatically, the reinforcement learning data being set up on top, and the model being fine-tuned automatically without us even touching it. So this is an example how infrastructure will actually drive the way models are going to be used. So if it's so easy and painless to swap Llama 2 and put instead of an Anthropic, why not? It's about better, faster, and cheaper.
Got it. So all the people who invested in these big models are going to lose all their money, huh?
I don't think so. Like electricity generating companies are not, they will turn into PG&E, right? And as much as we don't like PG&E, but I think they're going to be important part of the infrastructure underlying layer. Because you still need models, right? But they're going to be commodities.
Got it. So you're charging $300,000 per virtual worker. Can I have multiple virtual workers for that same $300, or do I have to pay $300 for every individual?
One virtual worker can do the work of thousands of people, right? So or automate processes for thousands of people. We separate those virtual workers by type of tasks or specialization they focus on. For example, you might have one virtual worker in a financial department who does quote to cash process, complete automation. But you can also have someone in legal department who is doing like the AI worker that does contract analysis and extraction from contracts, and then passing that information to another virtual worker. That's the beauty. They actually talk to each other. We also build this system where virtual workers not isolated. They talk to each other, passing information to each other. But in this case, you have 2 workers and you'll pay $300 each. And we see clients who started with 1 and going basically full scale with 3, 4, 5. And now putting much more millions of dollars in budgets.
So for $300K, I'm not buying a virtual worker. I'm buying a type of virtual worker, and then we can let that scale up as much as I want. And then they can all intercommunicate. So within all this data is being passed between these models now. I mean, data and security and AI are such a hot topic. So why is this integration of AI into enterprise business processes so scary for those enterprises?
Number one, because of the quality, right? We all heard stories about some engineer basically hacking, prompt hacking chatbot for the dealership company and buying Chevrolet Tahoe for $1, right? And things like this are inevitable when you have very generalized approach. Basically, you give LLM to do whatever you want it to do. But if you have a very specialized approach, the risk of having low quality is minimal or reduced to minimal. So one thing that enterprises all jump into, the use case is, of course, generative AI. Let's make it generate text. Let's do marketing emails, blogs, whatever. And it's great, but it's not bedrock of those processes that those organizations are running on. So if you are Fortune 1000 and you're using generative AI to generate marketing emails, well, it's still great improvements, but it's marginal. But if you are using generative AI solution to analyze, if your financial institution, for example, to analyze the fraudulent transactions and flag those and prevent those, this is where real ROI comes from.
So we've got data integrity issues, we've got compromised confidentiality, you've got just a whole number of different types of security issues with implementing AI, and these organizations are just beginning to understand the implications of it. Is that right?
Correct. And also startups who are trying to sell right now into enterprises, they will still have to have all those components to make sure it's enterprise grade solution they're delivering.
Given that you've been doing this for 7 years, you've kind of worked through all of these challenges. You've encountered them 4 or 5 years ago, found solutions for them, and now that's just part of the infrastructure that you're selling to people as part of the platform.
And we had to eat our own dog food. Before we build the platform, we had to build components and solutions ourselves to make sure that we deliver the highest possible quality. And then we started turning those components into a platform. But we, like, looking backwards, if we started to build platform from scratch, we would not even know what to build into it, what clients would need. We had to walk that path to actually understand it and realize it.
Right. It's interesting. It's almost like you started with a killer app, and then you built a platform on top of that. And that killer app was just basically reading long emails and summarizing them, because that's what every knowledge worker does. And then you've expanded from there. Okay. And so 5 to 10 years from now, what's this whole AI market look like? I mean, you've got Microsoft and Google, they want to supply all this stuff to the enterprise. You're supplying stuff. Okta's saying they're going to apply, you know, add AI into their existing product. How does the market evolve? I mean, all the listeners here are going to wonder what your prognostication is.
I'm a metaphor guy. I like metaphors because they explain things visually. So I think of it as a planet. And the planet will have two poles. One pole would be open source models, and another one would be closed source models. Both will exist, and they will have the benefits cons and pros. But there will be continents of, I would say, two main pieces where AI first companies building something that never been done before, because now they have ability to address use cases that without generative AI were not possible to address. And there will be also AI-enabled companies, like traditional software. Take Salesforce. They're investing a lot of into AI and doing it for a long time. Traditional businesses, traditional software that is AI-enabled. And those two worlds would coexist. It doesn't matter that one will win over another. It's just different use cases they're going to be addressing. And LLMs, as we know it, like providers of LLMs, would be, again, commodity. So we will not even think what model we are using inside the product. It's the output that we are using. And right now, most of the money goes to hardware providers because of kind of requirements for GPUs and everything, but it will also change. Models become smaller. They make less. They're less demanding for the for GPUs. We use hybrid approach. In our case, it's 10% of usage of GPU and 90% of CPU and the likes. So I would say everything is going to be commoditized, but the platforms that will be able to deliver the ROI to the end users or end customers going to be actually winning. Right now, it's opposite because it's very, I would say it's very immature market.
Your prediction is that you guys are going to be a platform. Is there going to be another platform or will it just be Hercules?
No, of course, there are going to be other platforms. It's obvious. It's a great, great way of building something that never existed before. Because in this case, when you have a platform, your clients are telling you what they need. You don't have to go and kind of reinvent the wheel or try to find the use cases. They are coming, they started building things, and you just provide them with ability to do that. That's where scalability comes from. So I would say it's absolutely obvious that a lot of companies will go that way. But what we see, even if they start now, it will take them time to build those components. Because it's so easy to prototype right now. You take a couple of models, slap blank chain on top, do rag, and it's still going to be a prototype. Clients don't want prototypes. I use the analogy all the time. We are at the dawn of aviation, of AI, right? It's a paper plane made out of dried wood, duct tape, and shit, and it's in the air. It's flying 300 yards. Amazing achievement. We were walking on the ground. Now we're in the air. But the enterprise clients need Boeing 777. All the infrastructure and a cocktail served in the first class. That's what they need. And we're still, as an industry, pretty far away from it.
Got it. So what is going on with, let's say, Google and OpenAI in that battle? What they're building now in terms of these LLMs are going to be subsumed to the platforms. But OpenAI has shown that they want to build some sort of a marketplace, at least, that they're thinking about how they move up into that sort of platform area by letting other people build applications. Is that something you're going to see them doing, or it's just not in their DNA?
Well, they might, and it's a pretty obvious idea, and it's a great idea. They definitely will be going this direction. But I don't think they're going to be going into hardcore enterprise because, again, that will require them building components, not just providing LLMs, or they will require developers to build those components. And it's still going to be hard. I would bet on Microsoft because Microsoft has a lot of those components already built. But regarding Google and OpenAI kind of a battle that we see right now, I think Google has a huge advantage. They have data. They have enormous amount of data. YouTube, they have Gmail, they have Google Docs. The problem with Google, as I see it, it's not technology. They have smartest people in the world and they have enormous amount of money. It's culture of innovation. And we know that culture eats strategy for breakfast. Where Google is Navy, OpenAI is like they are pirates. And I would always bet on pirates because they move faster. In this case, well, we'll see how it unfolds for Google. But so far, it's so interesting to see that battle unfolding from the sidelines and saying whoever wins, we will be using whatever is the best for our clients.
5 years from now, what are we going to be looking back and kicking ourselves for not realizing?
That's a great question. I would say we will probably be kicking ourselves for not realizing how still hard enterprise market is. And right now, we're kind of betting on like AI will change everything the same way we were saying cloud will change everything. And the way before that we were saying mobile will change everything and internet before that. And it did, but we are underestimating how much time and effort it will take. So whenever we think like, okay, I have a great technology and a product and all those possibilities, I'll win the market in 1 year. No way. It's still going to be long and expensive.
Okay. Well, Alex, this has been fantastic to talk with you. I think the fact that you've been at this now for so long and are so wise about how enterprise actually works and actually bringing AI to enterprise, you're like to the leaders in doing that. It's a real pleasure to hear your perspective on what's been happening, what's going to happen next. Thank you so much.
Thank you, James. It was a great pleasure.